Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello, friends. I'm Daniel Sherrill. Today on the show, for over 30 years, she's worked in women's health. She started her career as a nurse and today is a certified doula and childbirth educator who's helped welcome hundreds of babies into the world. She's passionate about working with people, talking about pregnancy and birth, and helping families settle into life with a new baby. As a mom of four herself, she's no stranger to all of those things. She says, quote, "I believe that birth is an extraordinary expression of who we are, and I've always felt privileged to walk alongside a family as they meet the challenges and joys that mark this profound transition." Please welcome Janet Hirsch Ettinger. Janet, welcome to the show.
Hey, Daniel. Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Thanks for jumping on board to talk about babies. This is so cool.
Happily. Favorite thing.
First question. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Pittsburgh. I'm like fourth generation Pittsburgh. But by the time I was eight, I had lived maybe seven different places. We moved around a lot when I was very young.
Military brat or what's the...
No, not at all. Messed up family divorce.
Hey, same as me.
Back and forth, coast to coast, figuring it out. But by the time I was eight, my mom brought us out to California and I really grew up in Santa Monica, which is lovely. And my father stayed back east. So I kind of went back and forth between coasts, bi-coastal. And then when I was 12, he moved to Israel. So then I spent my summers visiting him in Israel. So I did a lot of moving around one way or another growing up.
Wow. And what age were you in Israel?
During my teenage years, I would just go and spend the summers there. So that was late 60s, 70s.
I'm just really curious. What was that like?
Really different than it is now. Beautiful. He lived in Jerusalem. He had really interesting work being kind of an ambassador for people who were artists and politicians and historians who came over to the country. He would kind of show them around and be their person. Wow. So my father knew quite a bit of the history there. And it was really different in the sense that there were, I mean, of course, there were the divisions and there was war and with, you know, the neighboring countries. But within the country itself, it felt incredibly safe. And even as a 12 or 13 year old, I could go, you know, wander the Arab market, the souk, and do that safely and work on digs and, you know, excavating things, and had a lot of freedom because the country domestically felt very safe, even though they were at war with all of their neighbors. So it was like late 60s, early 70s. So an interesting time. Yeah.
And what was little Janet like as a child?
Oh, such an interesting question. I think I was very sensitive. I'm the youngest of three. I have a lot of really early memories or impressions or imprints of knowing what everybody around me was feeling, but I kind of flew under the radar. That's how I think of myself as a child. Mm. I think I learned the art of invisibility as a way of kind of feeling the room and reading things. And now I will say at the age of 63, I'm trying hard to unlearn the art of invisibility and be more present.
I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah. So it's interesting to reflect on that because it's something I think about a lot right now.
I'm curious, with your kids, do you see a lot of your own traits and the invisibility thing? Did you pass that on to them or did you try to encourage them not to be that way?
Yeah. It's both the things we recognize in ourselves. If we're awake to that, then we want that to be maybe different for our children or certainly the way we parent or the home we provide. But then there are traits that I see that are kind of innate that may, and so, you know, one of my kids, I really relate to him in terms of sort of how he's built internally and the things that are his strengths and the things that are challenges for him. And we talk about that a lot. Like we kind of lean on each other and give each other for support now that he's a grown man for some of those characteristics, but I recognize them in him. So it's a mix. Yeah.
That is very, very cool.
It's an interesting palette to think about your kids and what's genetic and what is picked up and what is reflects their other parent. And yeah.
I actually really like your use of the word palette because that really is, you know, every child, every person is just this conglomeration of all these different aspects of both parents and then their own upbringing and the community that they grow up in and all the external influences. Yeah. It's fascinating to think about.
It's really fascinating to me. I have to say, I think about it a lot. I think, reflect on them, learn from them. I love everybody is grown now. And I think it is the most fruitful. I mean, I loved being a parent when they were young, and four kids is chaotic. And I kind of liked the chaos, but I love seeing who they're becoming and how surprised I get by them. And as they grow into themselves and into their strengths, and it gives you a lot of confidence that ultimately everything turns out really well, no matter, you know, what the path. And they are my greatest teachers. And I really don't say that lightly, especially in the times we live in where that are political, thoughtful, wake up times. Our kids teach us an enormous amount. And I love that because it's vibrant. You know, it's a really vibrant relationship. Yeah.
So were there any particular experiences for you growing up that made you want to work as an RN or in women's health?
Well, I think two things. I had been a dancer. So the idea that I was very well seated in my body and still am.
Do you still dance?
No, I still move.
Good.
But a lot. I do a kind of movement that kind of involves meditation as well. So I think I incorporate things that way. Movement as an expression of your emotions and also recognizing that your body is your memory keeper. Mm. You know, everything's kind of imprinted there. But I think what led me into the world of healthcare is having my first child. And the experience of being pregnant and finding my way and advocating for myself at a time when there weren't doulas and there wasn't the level of information that there is now accessible to parents, available to parents. And I made choices in my pregnancy that really were about advocating for myself. I changed my doctor at the very end, just days before my son was born, in order to have a better care provider and a better experience. And after that, I moved, started working for doctors just as a job. And they trained me to be their back office person and drawing blood and giving shots and doing all that stuff. So that passion for women's health and for pregnancy and birth, and then a little bit of medical training led me into going to nursing school.
And I'm curious, what do you like most about healthcare after having worked in it now for over 30 years?
Well, what I love is what I love about the work I do in general, which is people and the relationships. And I think that's why I love being a doula rather than maybe just a nurse in a hospital. Not that they don't build relationships with their patients, but they're more short term. I like the long term relationships that I get to have with people. And also in the world of pregnancy, kind of helping people figure out who they are as they become parents. You know, when they become pregnant, they become parents. And there's sort of a whole psychological shift that happens as they take on that role. And then as they think towards how they want to give birth and how they want to parent, I love being part of that exploration with them. Mm. It's really a chance for them to kind of take stock of who they are and what their strengths are, where they need support, what their own parenting was like, what they might want to be different. So it's a pretty fascinating, intimate time in their lives. So I think I like the people part of it, the relationship.
And to take a step backwards for just a second, you hear the term doula nowadays quite a bit, actually. And for the listeners out there, to get the official definition from you, you hear things like birthing coach, a sometimes non-medical professional who's there to help out with the whole process. Can you tell the listeners exactly what a doula does and what they are?
Those things are aspects of it, certainly. But a doula is somebody who is there for physical and emotional support through the whole perinatal period. So whether that's pregnancy, birth, or postpartum. And to be an informational resource as well. So he or she has no medical role, but they can be a source of unbiased information to help parents develop the confidence to make their own best decisions. And I think that's a really key piece, is to not be the expert for them, but is to help them move into the role of a parent. I envision it like the kind of like a clicking of a wheel. And so they move from the place of being a child into the role of being a parent, and they're going to have a child then fill that space. And then their parent role, you know, kind of rounds the curve into being a grandparent. So everybody kind of shifts one place over. And so helping people figure out how they want to do that and what are their own best choices is what a doula does rather than making decisions for them.
What made you decide to go from nursing into being a doula and step away from the more clinical and medical role the more, I guess you would say, psychological and
emotional, more holistic, certainly. Although there are plenty of nurses that work holistically, but I think because I wanted to see people in that holistic way and develop a relationship with them that wasn't just about their physical care, but was about that psychological development as a parent, was about their cognitive needs for information and making decisions, was about what they needed emotionally. And a lot of times people seeking a doula maybe need that a little bit of that. They need that support. They recognize they want that support. Sometimes they want or need that support because they don't really have that in their own parent, or they don't feel safe being in labor or in birth with their own parent, but they're looking for somebody, because I am a little older. They're looking for somebody who kind of fulfills that role a little bit.
Like a surrogate parent?
A little bit. I mean, everybody has a different need from it. And that's also what's interesting, is finding out why somebody wants support and what do they bring to it and where can I enhance that for them and how can I support them.
And I would imagine that keeps it very fresh, that you're constantly getting new situations and new people, and it's never boring, I would guess.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the part that I love the most, is I get to meet people I would never have met, of all types and across all backgrounds and, you know, all demographics here in Los Angeles. And I get to kind of walk in curious and wanting to know who they are and why they've reached out and how I can enhance their experience. And for some people, that's just really physical. They just, you know, maybe they don't have a partner. Maybe it's a single mom. They need somebody by their side that way. For some people, they're information people and they want a lot of information. And I'm good on that. I'm an educator and I love researching and I love being unbiased and giving information.
You're the encyclopedia of childbirth.
Yeah, the new Google. And for some people, it's more spiritual, you know, and that's the last piece of that holistic thing, is they want to connect with their, and by spiritual, I don't necessarily mean religious or higher power, although for many it is, but a sense of connection to what birth is, to how help people find their meaning of what this transformation is. And some people are looking for somebody who will see them for that and support them that way.
Well, let's talk about demographics and diversity. Two-part question. One, is the field diverse? I would assume, maybe it's uneducated of me, but I would assume it's more women than men that do it. And the second question, demographics, I'm curious, when you look back across your career, are there any trends of the kinds of people that want a doula, or is it really spread all across the spectrum?
So the first part, it is mostly women, but there are men in this field. Sometimes there are men who will want to work with gay men. You know, that might be something that they're going to specialize in, so they can be a male and support that way, which seems wonderful. But that's not necessarily always true, but I've seen that. Or they want to do education of fathers, you know, father groups, things like that. Mm. But, you know, there are some male doulas, not a lot. And the other part was, have I seen a change? Oh, in who looks for a doula?
Yeah. I mean, it used to be like, I remember hearing the term years ago, and it seemed like, oh, that's something that wealthy people do or hippies do or whatever. You know what I mean?
Those are two. Those are two for sure. Those are the first two that come to my mind, like in the past. Like really.
But now it's such a common thing.
Yeah. So I do think that it's a broader spectrum of people interested in it, certainly along the coasts, you know, New York, California, you know, more urban centers. Money is an issue. And so there are plenty of doulas, but we could use more, who are addressing that and wanting to provide doula services to everyone, more like a community health worker. So I'd love to see us move towards a model like that. But that means our whole healthcare system kind of getting on board and recognizing the value.
Well, just quick sidebar, is it expensive to hire a doula?
So it could be anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to, I have heard, like $5,000 for a birth doula, but most doulas are somewhere around $2,000-ish. So that's a chunk of change for sure.
And yeah, but that seems more than worth it. I mean, you're going to spend more than that on a lot of stupid stuff in your life. That to have someone help bring your baby into the world, that just seems like an important expense.
Yeah, well, it's all about where you place value. Mm-hmm. But there's also truth that for people who want to have more agency in their birth, maybe whether that's a home birth or they would like to birth with less interventions in the hospital, which is can be a challenging thing, then a doula can be a really important source of support for that.
And to clarify, are you with them when they're actually having the baby, mm-hmm. or are you only beforehand?
Yeah. So, I mean, I meet with people prenatally quite a bit, a few times for nice long chunks of visit time, you know, so we can really get to know each other and do a lot of hands-on work and practice breathing and relaxation and touch and use different tools that we do to help kind of a woman be relaxed or a birthing person be relaxed. We talk a lot about postpartum and breastfeeding and self-care and the psychological aspects. And so we do a lot of prep on the front end. I'm a big believer in the more work we do on the front end, maybe the less there is to do in the birthing room. So I really encourage people to consider that we're not just doing this stuff for birth, but we want to be comfortable in our pregnancy. We want to be happy in our pregnancy to the degree that we can. We want to be connected with our birth partner. That all helps us connect with birth and with our baby. We want to connect with our babies as much as possible. They are in there listening and learning from us, especially in the second half of pregnancy. And so we want to do all this stuff because it makes us feel good in our pregnancy. And that is how we sort of bring that confidence and that happiness into our birth. And then that's how we and connected with our partner. And then that's how we bring it into our postpartum transition and our early parenting. So I'm a big believer that we work hard on the front end.
Is there a ratio of the number of people you have that are a couple versus a single person having a baby?
Yeah, far and away, couples is my demographic, only because, you know, most of my business is word of mouth. So most of my births are hospital births. I do some home births. Right now in COVID, more than I was, which is lovely, getting to go to more home births because my first was born in the hospital and my next three kids were born at home. So, you know, that has a very special place in my heart to do that.
I have questions about home birthing that, you know, people are usually afraid to ask. And the first one is, it's messy, you know, when a woman has a baby.
Yeah.
So is it all done like on a plastic tarp kind of thing? Or is it done in water? Like how is this great. Done?
I love that you're thinking the details. So birth is really messy. It's really messy. It's really juicy. But that's good because that helps a baby slide out, you know, so that's good to remember. Yeah. I always put that image into people's minds. So if we're birthing in a bed, then the way we prepare at home is we put a set of sheets, then we put a big plastic, you know, like tarp or a piece of plastic over that. And then we put another set of sheets that we don't care so much about on top of that. Yeah. So when it's all said and done, you know, we can get all cleaned up and throw those sheets away or throw them in the laundry and take off that plastic and trash it. And we have our nice cozy bed to be in at home. So that's how we help the mess. And people do birth in water as well, either their tubs or in birthing tubs that they rent. And we just drain those and clean those after.
That's fascinating. I'm curious, in 2020, besides COVID, but just generally in the business, what is the most challenging aspect of being in women's health for you?
Well, as a birth doula, I would say it's just birth takes a long time, especially first babies. Mm. So average first birth is like 22 hours.
Wow.
So, and I've been at births that are like 67 hours. So stamina.
What's the average birth weight of a child generally?
Oh, man. You know, it's 7-something now. Babies are bigger now than they were. We're healthier. We eat better. So our nutrition is better. Our prenatal care is better in this country. So we grow babies that are a little bit bigger than we did in the 50s when I was being born. And we hang on to our babies a little bit longer. We gestate a little bit longer than we
Interesting.
Used to as well.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. Huh. It's dynamic.
Does any of it have to do with like growth hormones or preservatives in the foods, or is that not a factor?
That's a fair question. I think I can't answer that definitively. Like most research, there's answers on both sides. You know, you could find research to support both claims. We do. I mean, there is some thought that girls menstruate soon, you know, earlier. The age of menstruation has moved back. So, and maybe that might have to do with some hormones in food, like milk and dairy products. But I don't know. I can't answer that.
Well, how do you feel about Western and Eastern medicine and their role in what you do?
I think it's great to avail yourself of both. I have a pretty good background in holistic medicine. I worked for some years for an acupuncturist, in fact. So I got to learn a decent amount about Chinese medicine and that philosophy and that application. And so I think they both have a lot to lend people. Mm-hmm. Western medicine tends to be very good in acute situations and emergencies, you know, acting fast. I think Eastern medicine tends to do very well with chronic disease because they just have a different way of looking at the body. Therefore, a different approach is like a different window in to the problem. But quite often using both is great. I think in as a rule in the West, we have overtreated pregnancy, seen it as a disease or looked at it sort of pathologically, which I think gets us into trouble. We sometimes intervene too much. And we have undertreated postpartum and haven't recognized that as a separate state that has its own needs. And we're starting to change that. And I feel like midwives and doulas have been part of moving that needle as well, helping to sort of view midwives in particular, helping to view pregnancy as a normal, healthy state, unless it isn't.
Is the difference between a midwife and a doula that the midwife is actually there taking part in the physical aspect of the birth?
A midwife has medical responsibilities. So in a normal, healthy pregnancy, a midwife is instead of an obstetrician. So in a home birth or hospital birth that use midwives, she is responsible.
Are there a lot of midwives who are doulas?
There are a lot of doulas that become midwives. Yes, definitely.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
They get to know birth and then they want to have more agency in it, so to speak.
In all the years you've been doing this, have you ever considered quitting?
No. I, you know, I'm getting older, so I do consider that I don't want to do a bunch of births every month anymore. You know, for me, one or two is great as opposed to my younger colleagues that can do more. But I also am finding kind of a deeper, richer work and trying to find some maybe new avenues in what I do, both as a teacher, working with people healing postpartum. I offer something that is based on Central and South American tradition called closing of the bones, which is done at the very end of postpartum, like at 4 or 6 weeks postpartum. And it involves this caretaking of a mom so that you recognize that she's come to kind of the end of her journey, of her pregnancy journey. And it involves massage and like herbal steam baths and a wrapping of the body. And it's this very lovely ceremony or ritual that helps us kind of make meaning from our experience. So I love that work. I love the relationship.
I got to tell you, I'm not going to have a baby, but I want to have that done.
I want to have that too. Agreed, right? I think that's kind of what I was saying about Western medicine has kind of helped women have their babies pretty much in the hospital in the 20th century and now the 21st, and then just send them home 2 days later without a lot of care for what a tender time that is, not just physically, but emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. And other cultures, Indian culture, Chinese tradition, Ayurvedic tradition, has a sort of a lying in period of 30 to 40 days where a woman stays home and she's fed certain foods and kept warm. And this kind of massage and steam baths that I'm describing are all part of her care to make her well and whole again after having this experience of pregnancy and birth, which is a lot on a body. And also to give her time to sort of sink into, you know, becoming a mother. I mean, when we give birth, we give birth to ourselves as well, you know, as parents. And I don't think our culture has recognized that as much as it's needed to. We have a pretty high level of postpartum depression and anxiety, quite a bit higher than certain other countries. And it's the most common complication of childbirth is postpartum depression and anxiety. 15 to 20% in our culture are diagnosed with that.
Wow.
So we are starting, you know, now we're doing much better. In Los Angeles, we have a lot of resources for it that people need to know about.
And what causes that? Is it a hormonal thing? Is it an emotional thing?
Yeah, but kind of all of that. I mean, it's definitely triggered hormonally. Just before you give birth, your labor hormones, like your estrogen, is the highest it will ever be in your life. And then 24 hours later, it plummets like by 90% or something. And so hormonal ups and downs. Some of us ride those waves, because even men, we all have hormonal ups and downs. Some of us ride them like a gentle wave, and some of us, it's like a roller coaster, you know, like very sharp ups and downs. So for some women, that is a trigger that changes their brain chemistry so that they are not, they either have depression or anxiety. Sometimes a history of mental illness can be a definite, you know, precipitating factor as well, or of struggling with anxiety or depression, family history. There are different factors. Lack of support, lack of sleep can be a trigger for some of these things, right? So you can see how important
it
is.
Well, lack of sleep is a trigger for many other things as well in life.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's where that caretaking, and that's where, this is not work I do, but like a postpartum doula who really supports the family when they get to the other side. That can be such an important service if you don't have family that's there for you.
What do you think is the most important aspect of women's health globally?
Globally? Well, globally is access to it and honoring women in healthcare, even like when we are doing trials with medications, you know, women aren't included enough, or people of color aren't included enough. We're very much a patriarchy globally across the world, and our medicine is focused that way as well. So honoring women's experience and their needs in the same way that we have traditionally honored men, I would say.
So what's it like for you during a delivery? You're kind of sitting there in the next to the mom or the dad or whatever, and you're encouraging and saying things, or what do you physically or emotionally actually do?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I feel like I'm like a Sherpa, like a navigator, you know, because I've done this. I haven't done their birth, but I have walked with people through birth quite a lot. And so I have a sense of the road ahead and what it might be like for them. And I've walked with people who might be like them. Birth is different for everyone. Some women are very internalized. Some women are telling you everything. We all have a different pain tolerance, some of which is just biologically determined, you know, how our brains perceive pain in the body. So getting to know who that woman is, but kind of knowing what the process is and normalizing it for her, helping her to feel safe, that she is safe, because birth can be scary, pain can be scary. So knowing that this is her body working, knowing that she has the support she needs. I have a big goal, if there's a partner, which there usually is making sure that partner, that navigating is very much geared towards the partner, because they're still in their brain, like their modern brain in the room, watching this person they love, making a lot of sounds and moving their bodies in ways they've never seen before. And it can look really scary. So you also want the partner to know this is fine and how to help encourage her. So a big goal of mine is helping them feel safe, and modeling things, ways I touch, ways I talk, ways I look at her, that the partner can do. And I always say to people when I first meet them that we're going to develop like some tools in their toolkit, but the biggest tool they have is already in there, and that's the relationship between the two people, because they know each other and trust each other and probably love each other dearly. That's how they got there. And that's the biggest thing that they need, is that connection between each other. So I want to support that. Sometimes that means being really hands-on and touching and squeezing hips and cleaning up mess and getting her in and out of a shower. And sometimes it's a little bit more hands-off and just being there because the partner's doing such a beautiful job.
Have you gotten any kind of weird or unique requests over the years?
No, to be honest, I haven't I've had really interesting serendipitous things that have happened, the way people came to me or things they ascribed to me. But I think sometimes afterwards you realized why somebody wanted you there. Mm. And quite often it does have to do with you being there as a mother, as a mothering presence for them. And or sometimes people are there because they do want you to kind of run interference with their family. And so if they can say, we have a doula, so it's cool, we don't need you during the birth, that's their way of managing their family.
$2,000 well spent.
For some people, that's priceless. Yeah.
What's something about birth and the whole process that most people don't know that you think they should?
I think that you don't have to be any one type of person to have a wonderful birth experience. You could be a yogi, you could be a lawyer, you could be into meditating, you could not be, you could be in great shape or not great shape, you could want all the information or not want to know a thing. And I have had clients who wanted no information, but just trusted that their body could do this, or had a religious belief that their body could do this, and that saw them through. So I'm always learning, what is it that sees somebody through? I'm always learning from that. But that every woman will, or I should say birthing person, because not everybody identifies as a woman who's giving birth, so I want to honor that. Every birthing person, no matter how they birth or what choices they make or whether their baby comes out their vagina or their belly, will find their inner warrior in a way they have never met that part of themselves before, I guarantee. And will also be their very most vulnerable, open self, which is where a birth partner and a doula have entree, because it's how we can support them. Hmm. So it's two sides of a coin that you get to discover about yourself.
I know women personally that are very scared to have a child, and some that are so afraid of it that they've said, nope, never. Do you think that they're more afraid of what you just said about confronting those things than they are about the physical pain of just a bowling ball coming out of their vagina? Or do you think, I'm just curious in your opinion and talking to women over so many years, what do you think is behind that fear the most?
I think all of those things, many things. Birth is, there's very little control in birth. You know, we can prepare our minds and our bodies to meet the experience, but we don't know what the experience will be like for us when it's our first time. And that's a very unique position to be in. There's very little in our life that we actually can't know more about what it's going to be like and how we're going to manage it.
You know, what's fascinating about you saying that is that death is the exact same way. And then they're both two sides of the same life, you know?
They are the same energy. And I have been with a few people when they've passed, my mom most recently this year, and it is the same energy, and a hospice nurse does the same work that I do, not just with the person dying, but with that person's family, helping them navigate what it's going to look like as we come around the next bend and the next bend. And while it's unique to the individual, he or she, that hospice nurse, has walked this road enough times, just like a birth doula, to be able to be that Sherpa for them. So the unknown, I think, is very hard in our culture. Western women don't necessarily think that things should hurt. whereas many other cultures, labor hurts just as much, but that's just normal. That's what labor is. And you just get through the other side. It's nothing to manage. It's just something to get through. We have an idea about managing things. I think that's scary to us to kind of let go that way. And women are afraid of pushing a baby out. That like you asked that question, that idea of like, how do I let something out of my body like that? How do I release? How am I not broken by that? There's a big surrender around that. There's a lot of sensation in pushing, but the vagina, just like the penis, is meant to grow and meant to get small again, right? So the vagina does that work as well, to kind of a bigger degree.
A much bigger degree.
Yeah. But that's a scary thing. And it's normal to be scared of that. And I like to say that to people too. I mean, it's kind of intelligent to be afraid of something you've never done before. Like, bring that fear with you. Bring everything with you. Bring your whole self to the party, you know?
Well, how do you feel about sexual health and childbirth education? And also, how do you think it affects humanity growing up without sexual health education and with it?
So we give, we're better giving information. We're better at least in our public schools, integrating health education and sexual health education. But I think the important piece is the emotional aspect. And what does it mean to be a sexual being? What does that mean emotionally? What is the responsibility that you have for that? What does it mean to give or ask for consent? What does it mean to have agency and power over your own body? And so I think parents with young children now that I see it doing, see them doing it well, is they're having these conversations early on about your body and who gets to touch it. And even when you go to the pediatrician, that person should be asking for permission, you know, and they, and we see that, we see pediatricians instilling these lessons too. So I think sexuality and sexual education needs to be about so much more than how babies are made and birth control and STDs. And I think we're slowly getting to that about women having power over their own bodies and men as well, and how to be in respectful, consensual relationship, even if it's just to have sex. It doesn't have, you know, even if that's the nature of the relationship, right?
But yeah,
the consensuality of it, we need to be building that into our children from early on.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a transactional sexual relationship, right, as long as both people consent to it.
Absolutely. You know? It's a normal, healthy thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think being in healthcare has made you a better or worse parent?
I think it's made me a better parent, actually, because I think that I get to be with so many different people and see so many different ways of being that I think it just opens me up to whoever my kids want to be, or seeing parent, I watch other parents, how they parent their babies or how they talk to their partners. And I think, wow, I have a lot of respect for that. That's really beautiful. I didn't think about that when my kid was little. Like, I learned so much. I don't have grandkids yet. Would love to one day. And I think I would be kind of, not that I'd be their parent, but I would see them in a different lens, with a different lens than maybe I saw my own, partly because they won't be mine. I don't have that level of responsibility, but partly because of what I've learned over my years of working with families and seeing ways of parenting that I hadn't thought of, or ways of respecting children or respecting who they are from the moment that they come through, or even when they're still in the womb, and how sentient and aware and conscious they are, and how even when we change that newborn's diaper, we'd be talking to that newborn about, you know, I'm going to change your diaper right now. I mean, this is going to feel cold. I'm going to lift your clothes off, you know, whatever it is, like narrating that as a way of including them in the experience, as opposed to just doing something to children. So I think I would do that differently when I had grandchildren. And I think, you know, it has made me a better parent.
What would you say to the naysayer that would look at you and go, oh, that's silly. The kid's, you know, 6 months old. They're not going to know what you're doing or whatever. Like, why talk to them? Why narrate?
Yeah. Well, partly we narrate because I think it keeps us healthy too. Because if you're alone with a kid all day long, it's helpful to be like, okay, we're going to change another diaper. Like, it kept me sane to narrate. I think narrating builds emotional vocabulary. I strongly, strongly believe that, that we, you know, I know you don't like your diaper change. It's really cold, the air, you know, or I know your tummy is hurting, like to give, that they count enough, that you care enough, and you give some words for what they're feeling, but can't say yet because crying is a baby's language. So you start to build that emotional vocabulary. And I guess, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of research that is starting to bear out what I'm saying, that we do imprint our experiences, our early experiences.
Yeah. And there's, what's fascinating is there's also scientific evidence now to show that the musicality of our speech and the tone with which we speak to an infant, they do understand some of it. They understand, you know, a harsher tone versus a sweeter tone. So it's fascinating.
Absolutely. There's so much they're picking up on, or, there's such interesting research about how much babies are learning in the womb that we can test after, you know, after they're born, developing taste preferences and music preferences, and they're in there dancing there. You know, we can look at all that now because of technology. But even the way babies respond to how you play with them, like typically, you know, like a heart rate will go up when a dad will, you know, a male energy is playing with the baby, and a similar, you know, and the opposite happens when mom is holding and playing with the baby. And you know, we always, you know, say how good it is that babies have both experiences, you know, to have a duplicity of experiences, to be lucky enough to have two parents that give them, you know, different feelings in their body. But just innately, we see biological difference, or we see physiological differences in terms of how people play with them and talk to them, and we can record that. So you're right, they are registering a lot of that.
What's the most valuable lesson that you think you've learned so far from your career?
To be curious. To just be interested in what is going to happen, and that that is the best guide for how to manage a situation.
Well said. Because of the incredible things that technology does, I'm just curious if you think in the future we're going to find a way for men to have babies.
I have no basis for this, but I think yes.
As do I, oddly.
I don't really know why, but I think yes.
Yeah, like in a couple hundred years, we'll have like a little papoose sack that you put on or something. And then
be like male seahorses. Yeah.
Be cool if you could transfer the baby back and forth, you know, like, can you
I think
take the
there's
kids
a lot of women who would go for that, actually. Sharing the load would have a lot of appeal.
Now, Janet, are you a fan of traveling?
I am a fan of traveling, but I have not traveled nearly as much as I would like to. But to let you know, when I was 16, and so I did move around a lot as a child, like I said, and back and forth and to Israel and back and all of that. So I loved being on planes. I loved airports. And when I got my driver's license, I used to, for like 2 years, I would borrow my mom's car and like once a month drive out to the airport. And those are the days where you could just park and go up to the gate. And I would just like watch like people coming and going because I loved that exchange.
Well, I did that during high school. We would people watch, and then we would just go sit at the observation deck and watch the planes come in and go.
Yeah.
And seriously, it would be like 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, and you're like, "Hey, bud, you want to go to the airport?" Yeah, and we just drive to the airport. And just.
I love that. So yes, I mean, I even when we take teeny little trips, I always imagine what it would be like to live there. I'm always wondering what those people are doing in those houses that I'm passing. I'm always really curious about that.
Where's your favorite place that you've traveled?
Let's see. I have kind of a tie. We did a wonderful family trip to Alaska. And we did it for like 2 weeks and we stayed on land. We didn't do like a cruise or anything. We just stayed in this teeny little town and rode bikes and took boats and got to know all the townspeople. And it was sort of magic. Mm. I loved that trip. And I mean, we went to Italy last year. That was amazing. I loved Rome and Venice. Spent some time in Guatemala. I love Guatemala.
Do you have a dream trip that you haven't taken yet that you really want to?
So do.
Ooh, I can't wait.
So hoping you would ask. I don't know why.
Wait. Don't tell me. I'm going to guess.
Okay, go.
Cleveland, Ohio.
That's it. You're amazing. No wonder you do this podcast. Do you do like that trick with everybody where you come up with something?
I just named my hometown because like, everyone wants to. Why would you not want to go to Cleveland?
Ireland. I have always wanted to go to Ireland. I don't know. I just got to see that green. I love that. The language, the music. I just want to do a long walking trip in Ireland.
It's one of the best accents in the entire world, I think.
Yes. It's so romantic. I mean, it just takes you away. I don't know. I love it.
Well, how has the proliferation of digital technology in the world changed your career?
Well, thank God. Yeah, thank God with COVID, because we can be Zooming and teaching childbirth classes and even giving birth support or birth preparation or answering postpartum questions, you know. So in that sense, technology is great. But I would say the downside is we're just so, we have, I'm not coming up with the word, but basically we look to the outside for all our information. And so people are obsessive about Googling things and what's the best product and is this okay to do and what is this diagnosis? And I think the downside of that is we have a lot of knowledge internally, and especially when we're pregnant, the hormones of pregnancy really kind of bathe the limbic center of our mind, our more primitive emotional part, out of which, you know, that's the place from which we think intuitive knowledge arises. And there's nothing very mystical about intuitive knowledge. It's just, it's our emotional sense of ourselves. It is what we know about ourselves. It's our experiences. It's what we've imprinted in our bodies. And I think if we can kind of use our intuitive self along with our more modern prefrontal cortex and combine those two, then we can make really good choices. But I think we've gotten to this place where we think Google knows everything, and it creates a lack of confidence in our ability to birth and parent that I think is a shame. So I think that's a downside to the digitalization of our world.
When you look back on your whole life, do you feel like you've got it all figured out? Career, family, job, life? love?
God, no. No, I'm really grateful. And I feel like I have a really nice, like my circle's complete. If I had to go tonight, I would feel fine about that, really. But I make a lot of mistakes and family life is messy and relationship is messy. And I think the only thing that maybe I have a little more figured out than I used to is to be okay with that and, you know, have compassion for myself.
You know, I have to tell you, people don't realize, but hosting a podcast, the thing that I like the most about it, not just meeting really cool people and talking to friends and all this stuff, but I get to hear so many different kinds of human beings talk about the perspective of life from young to old and different careers. And you glean from it, you start to see these trends of what it means to be human, which is the whole point of me doing the show. And it's fascinating to take from it so far, about a year and a half or whatever into it, that most people in the world walk around going, yeah, man, I don't know. I'm just doing my best. Enjoy your life as long as you've got it. Quit stressing this, you know, the small stuff, and just be happy as much as you can, because you don't have as much time as you'd like. And, you know, so it is fascinating to see so much evidence of that in so many facets of human existence.
Have you kind of taken that in? Like, has that informed any of your choices or perspectives?
Yes and no. I mean, I have tried to have perspective and think about what the future Daniel would say so that I can live for today and not have anxiety and stuff. But of course, that's just, it's easier said than done. There's a great moment in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams that kind of references this, and I'm going to paraphrase a bit, but in this conversation near the end between Slarty Bartfast and Arthur, Slarty Bartfast says, "Perhaps I'm old and tired, but I always think that the chances of finding out what really is going on are so absurdly remote that the only thing to do is say, hang the sense of it and just keep yourself occupied. What does it matter? I'd far rather be happy than right any day." And Arthur says, "And are you?" And Slarty Bartfast replies, "No." That's where it all falls down, of course.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is to be human, right?
Yeah.
We're limited. We're like, that horizon is out there. We can only see so far, you know, but we know that there's more than that. I mean, we just have to live with a not knowingness, with a certain, even emptiness or yearning, and we can have that too, like incorporate that too, maybe.
Do you feel like the majority of your life when you're walking around the world, are you generally happy or content, or do you feel lonely and uncertain?
So I'm generally happy, positive person overall. I'm scared. I carry a lot of, like, doing this with you. I obsessed way too much about it. I carry a lot of fear, but I know that about myself, and I'm just, you know, okay, keep going. So that's who I am. Jump anyway. But yeah, I tend to be positive and feel good.
I am very similar to you in that. I also have fears that I carry around about life. And then I have this very conflicted personality, because part of me has the fear and a little bit of the anxiety about the future and not knowing. And then the other part of me, like I said, hears all these people talk, had good advice from my own family. And I know that at the end of your days, you'll look back and go, "Oh, that worry was not worth it. Why did I bother with this? So stupid. It all worked out anyway, you know?"
Totally.
So I try to really focus on that and bring it into my everyday and be present, as everyone says today. But that is for me where the greatest challenge is knowing it's all going to be okay. And who cares about the future? Let's just live for today. And then feeling the fear and the anxiety of the stupid stuff in life, you know?
Yeah.
And I haven't figured it out. So if I do, I'll let you know.
Please do. I'm still riding that train.
Well, it's encouraging to know that, you know, you're a couple years older than me and you're still riding that train. So that's like, oh, good. I'm not alone, you know?
Absolutely.
If you hadn't worked for so many years in healthcare, what do you think you would have done with your life?
I love words. And language. I think I would have wanted to been like a linguistics teacher or something like
that. That's cool.
I'm a big reader and I just love words and the whole, how dynamic language is and how much it changes and how much it reflects different, the context of when it's spoken, you know, when those words or phrases were used. So
yeah.
I think I'd want to do something geeky like that.
That's cool. That's not geeky at all. That's awesome. Are there any career ambitions you have that you haven't achieved yet and want to, or do you think you've achieved them all?
I kind of alluded to trying to find like maybe a little deeper work within what I do and a little less physical. I'm very attracted to breath work and being expression of who we are emotionally. And I want to get kind of more training in that, like meditation, breath work, to maybe be able to work therapeutically with people. And I'm not even really sure what that means, but so it's part of what I'm exploring right now.
That's really fascinating. That's cool. Jenny, what was your favorite childhood book?
Oh, I read a lot of Nancy Drew. but what comes to mind is this book called Caddy Woodlawn. And it just like popped in my head when you asked the question. And I think it was like some prairie girl's life or something, you know, Little House on the Prairie kind of thing. But now I'm going to have to go Google it and find out what it was. But the book just popped right in front of my face when you asked me that question. I was a big reader. Back then you also had encyclopedias, right? So I loved hanging out, just like grabbing an encyclopedia and like getting on the bed and just like
flipping to some random page,
and just getting lost. So yeah.
When you look back on your life today, how have your priorities changed since you were 20, 30, 40, 50, et cetera?
I'm much more content to appreciate what I have than I was when I was younger. I definitely was always looking for what I didn't have or what I needed to be that I didn't feel I was. And certainly my family, my children have been the heart of my life. They're just, you know, we carry our children in our hearts. And as people who have, as women who birth, we literally have all of our children, like cells from all every pregnancy we've ever had, even ones that didn't come to fruition, are roaming around in our bodies. And I feel that way about my children, that they're just so deep within me. And that's the heart of my life.
Do you think that women have a closer connection to their children than men do just because they do birth them?
I don't feel I can answer that. I mean, certainly when we talk about the idea of love, no, I don't think that women love their children more than men can love their children. But I do think there's something to that thing I just described, that I literally have my baby cells in me.
Well, do the men have the cells too, though, because they have the other half of the genome?
It's a really good question. I think it comes from actually having, you know, started that life, that embryo and then fetus, because those dividing cells are in you.
Well, and the picture comes together in the mother. You know, you've got these two separate parts that are individual. And then
that's such a deep question. And I would in no way assume that I love my children more than their father.
What do you do with your spare time? What are your hobbies?
I love crossword puzzles, reading, hiking. We have a new dog. So I'm walking the dog a lot.
What kind of dog?
She's a golden retriever mix. I think she has some chow in her.
Oh man. Golden retrievers are my favorite dog.
She's a rescue. She's an amazing dog who has just like kind of walked in and went, okay, I got your family. Just like slipped right in. She's this little puppy rescue. Well, she's not little. She's a year and a half and she's, you know, 50 pounds, but she's great. So she's what I do a lot. Right now.
And let's talk about my favorite part of the show, food. Do you have a favorite meal you've eaten somewhere in the world?
Yes. What comes to mind is, but it's not that it was fancy, but it was like hard fought for. it was a trip to Guatemala with all the kids, or almost all the kids. And it was pouring rain and it was like in a kind of dicey area. And there was just mud pouring down the streets. And my son, who lived there at the time, thought he knew how to get us somewhere and he kind of didn't. And then we were on the Caribbean and we just like caught a boat, and the boat said, I can take you somewhere, and took us to this little like island restaurant that was this piece of heaven. And we never expected it. And it was like 10 o'clock at night. And we all sat down dripping wet at this table and ate the most delicious Guatemalan food. And it was just like, wow, I never would have thought we would have ended up here after walking the last 2 hours down muddy streets, like feeling lost and unsafe.
What a great story. I love it. If you were elected president of the United States today, what are the first three things you would do?
I strongly believe that everybody needs their basic needs met. So I don't know how many groups you would have to convene for that, but that everybody had shelter, food, and access to healthcare in some way, in the most basic way. It breaks my heart that we can do that and that we don't do that. And I don't understand that. And it's a big part of my life is that kind of service work and teaching my kids that kind of service work as well. They were raised that way. So yes, to take care of basic needs.
Number two,
I really believe in some kind of compulsory community service year after high school. And, you know, could be military, if that's what makes sense to you. But that rather than going off, and there are countries that have this, but rather than going off to college, taking at least a year to grow up, but being of service. Mm-hmm. And I think it could do a lot of good in this country. And I think financially, it could work as well. And I think there are studies that show, given that year, doing something like AmeriCorps, a lot more kids who might not have gone to college go to college. And I think even kids who are college bound after that year or two make different choices around what they want out of their education.
I completely agree.
Yeah. And three, well, it has to do with education because I'm not exactly sure what, but I think education is the heart of everything and is the heart of creating equity or more equity. But we need to have equitable education to start mm-hmm. with, which we do not. And it's also heartbreaking. So I'm not being specific, but all children should have access to a robust education, a multicultural education. And we need to teach more about government. And these last two election cycles and this last presidency have shown me that I don't think people understand enough coming out of high school how our government works.
I agree.
And separation of church and state and the three prongs of government and their individual, you know, the independence from one another and checks and balances. I feel like so many people in this country don't know how our government works.
Yes, and why it works that way.
Yeah, and why, where it came from. And, you know, I do agree it should be more dynamic than it is and maybe change with our times. And I guess that would be my fourth, would be getting like special interest money out of elections, if I could do that.
And I would add to that, get rid of the Electoral College system.
Yes.
This is me personally.
Yes, or have an Electoral College system that is proportionate.
Yes.
As opposed to all for one. That makes no sense to me.
Well, one of my favorite questions to ask on the show is this one. If you could sit for 4 hours in some old-timey pub with one person from all of human history, alive or dead, but excluding any prophet like Jesus, Moses, or Muhammad, and anyone in your own family, who would you sit with? What would you drink? And what's the first question you would ask them?
Can I have two together?
Sure. Captain and Tennille?
No. Okay, so so two women come to mind for me. One is Martha Graham, which you brought up before.
Awesome.
And the other is Georgia O'Keeffe. Both are artists. Both are women who had really strong, they were strong women in a time when men dominated their fields more or less. Especially Georgia O'Keeffe as a visual artist. They had such a drive to share their emotional body, especially Martha Graham, how life felt to her and to translate that into movement, or Georgia O'Keeffe, like the raw beauty of the landscape and the emotions that that evoked in her. So I'm just in awe of that. And what would I ask them?
What would you drink? Would you drink?
Like something really smoky, like something with mezcal in it, or something. Yeah, dark and smoky.
All right. So you're sitting in this old timey pub. There's some mezcal on the table and these two women are here with you. What's the first question you'd ask them?
What is it kind of how you started with me? Like, when did you first hear your voice and know that you wanted to speak through your medium, whether it was through dance or through painting? Like, what was your first experience of knowing who you were and wanting to share that with the world?
Great question. That's awesome. Well done, Janet. Some people say that things in the world today are the worst they've ever been. Some people, like me, feel that things are the best they've ever been. I'm curious, what do you think?
Well, I think we should feel very lucky for living in, despite all the fucked up stuff we talked about.
Despite everything, yeah.
We can live more healthfully. We can live more connected if we choose. We have, you know, the prospects of possibly inhabiting other planets, which we need to soon. So I think, and being able to know what is happening around the world. I mean, I know that can be a bombardment in terms of social media, but it makes your world so large too, you know, to be able to know how people live and create and love and die all over the world, just like makes my world bigger, makes my heart bigger. So I think I'm fortunate to live in this time.
And sidebar, I meant to say my condolences for losing your mother, because, you know, I lost my dad two years ago and been on that journey for a while now. So I'm sorry.
Thank
for
you.
Your loss.
Likewise for you. I love that you talk about it still and that it's important to you.
Yeah. I wish that death were talked about more in our world so that you kind of, not that you can know what the experience is going to be like, because you won't until you get there, but to at least know some of the things that you might be going through and that are going to happen and what it's like to watch someone die in front of you. And, you know, I wish we talked about that so that people had a better idea. And I do think that if we were able to convey those things to human beings, I think it would actually, and I mean this when I say these words, completely change humanity, and that we would all generally appreciate life a lot more and be nicer to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. But to normalize, I mean, we're like living every day, you know, just afraid of dying. I mean, that's many people's entire existence. And if we could make that okay, you know, like it's a passage, just like birth is a passage. But I don't know.
Are you afraid of dying?
I don't think so, but you'll have to ask me when I'm right there if I've changed my mind.
Well, if I am there, it would be an honor. So,
and I think you would be a great person to have there. Like,
oh, thank you.
A good person to have in one's lifeboat, I can tell. So,
thank you. I like that lifeboat. I like it. Are you happy with the journey of life overall?
Yeah, I am.
If you can continue to live a healthy life, and that means mentally and physically, how long would you like to ideally live?
I guess I don't have a number, as long as I still had like a reasonable semblance of a mind. It's already changing. So I can see that coming. I guess I wouldn't want to like be in pain.
Right.
To, you know, like every day that defined my day.
Yeah.
So then I don't have a number. I don't know.
Awesome. We'll just leave it out there for whenever.
And you're going to be there.
If you could travel. If you could travel back in time and see your 16-year-old self and have a conversation, what would you tell young Janet?
Just slow down. Just, just enjoy the day. That's all. I know I was in a rush to grow up and get past things. And I missed a lot.
I agree. And I often think, well, if most of the people I talk to, including myself, would tell their younger version of themselves, hey, slow down. Don't stress that stupid shit. Just enjoy your life. You've got so many years ahead of you and all these things. If that's what we would all tell our younger selves, then what about the version of us 20 years from now? So in my case, 70-year-old me, what would he tell 49-year-old Daniel, you know? And if he would tell me the same thing, dude, slow down. Like, you don't have to get all 30 episodes of the podcast edited this week. Enjoy your life. You know, I try to actually think about that a lot, which feeds into our earlier conversation about daily anxiety. Because if older version of me would say that, then why can't I seem to just chill out now?
And incorporate it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a habit. And I think that that's where my fascination, I was saying, like about the body being an imprint of our experience or our breath recording our experience. We just get into a habit where we start playing that I'm afraid of that. And then my body starts feeling afraid. And then all the things that happen mentally that go with that. And I recognize I don't need to do that, but I've sort of trained myself to do it. So my interest is, can we break some habits at this age, like unimprint or imprint new things and have confidence in that?
When people say, oh, they're too old to change, I've never believed that. I understand things become, like you said, habit, but I think you can re-imprint and unlearn some things. And
that's my hope. That's what I'm working on.
Yeah. You and me both. All right. What do you think is the purpose of art?
To connect, like something that you see is beautiful, or like you were saying, like when your friends say something, like you've been recording their words. It's for me, at least, because I used to write a lot when I was young as well. It's like feeling something or being moved by something and seeing the light hit something in a particular way, whatever it is, or the way something sounds, or the breath, the air on your face, and wanting to share that with someone else, like wanting somebody to feel it the way you do, I guess, as a point of connection. Because like we said, there's a lot of emptiness inside, you know, like we are, as much as we surround ourselves with people or have families or whatever, ultimately we are walking this alone, you know, it's you in your experience.
Well, and that's like when I'm eating a really good meal, whoever I'm with, I'm like, you got to try this. This is so good. And sometimes people are like, dude, I got my own. Just, I'm like, no, but you don't understand. We have to share this.
I need you to try this. Open up your mouth.
Yes. Yeah. What does success in life look like to you?
Wanting what you have, being good with that.
And also and having
what you
want.
I know. I have to think about why I don't want to say that one.
What's your spirit animal?
A giraffe.
Ooh, cool. Why?
Well, it might have to change, but I just think they're so regal. I love that long neck. You know, they're like a ballet dancer, right? And they see far, but the reason I said it might have to change is they don't vocalize very much, do they? Mm. They don't make sounds or not very much. And so maybe a giraffe was the first half of my life, and my spirit animal maybe will change as I want to be more vocal in my life. I don't know. But that's always been my animal.
That's cool. Giraffes are badass.
And they have a purple tongue. They really are. I think a purple tongue's amazing. Yeah.
I got to feed a giraffe at the San Diego Zoo, and their tongues are like so long. Yeah.
They're regal.
Janet, as you may know, at the end of every show, I do a little game called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird. I've collected 299 philosophical and life questions from friends, family, and the internet. So you get to pick two numbers from 1 to 299, and I will read you those two random questions.
Okay. 3 and 147.
All right. Number 3. What smell do you love?
Vanilla.
That's a good one. Now, is there a reason why?
It's creamy and it has a lot of depth to it.
Now, do you have a bunch of vanilla stuff around the house, like vanilla candles and vanilla sprays?
Not necessarily.
Do you cook with vanilla?
Sure. I have a lot of spices. It's up in my spice cupboard.
Number 147. Have you ever had dreams about a past life?
Definitely.
Would you like to share one?
Well, I to go back to my travel question, if we've had past lives, I think I have I don't know if they were good or bad, but I think I've had strong ones in Ireland. There's just something so like it's in my blood, something so resonating. And yes, I have had like dreams about being there. I don't remember anything specifically, but it's like been a theme for me my whole life.
That's cool. So. Well, Janet, I can't thank you enough for being on the show and talking about all these wonderful life experiences. You're great. And I really hope you have a fantastic rest of your career, and say hello to your children for me. And you take care of yourself.
Thank you. This was, it's a very unusual situation to be able to just talk with somebody who's just going to be interested in you for an hour, hour and a half. And I'm honored by that. I want you to know that.
I assure you the honor is mine. Truly.
Thank you.
Truly.
Thank you.
You take care.
All right. You too. Bye.
Friends and listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Janet's doula services, you can check out her awesome website at thebellyblossom.com. That's thebellyblossom.com. And while you're there looking up cool baby stuff, why don't you head on over to patreon.com/moonbird and throw a couple bucks our way to keep the show going. We really, really appreciate it. And as always, if you'd like even more Moonbird in your life, then head on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media @memoriesofamoonbird. Remember, wrap your rascals and stay safe.